Thanks, everyone, for coming out. Just to make sure everyone's in the right place, we're 113 A, B, and C for avoiding most common OSHA citations in breweries. Today speaking, we have Gabe Sierra. He's Managing Director for Prometrics Safety Consulting and former Chief of Staff for OSHA from 2006 to 2009. Let's give him a hand and welcome Gabe.
Thank you, everybody, for attending this OSHA presentation, and hopefully you'll be able to walk out with some background and some useful information that you can use back at your breweries. A couple of comments. A copy of the presentation is loaded up onto the website, so if you want to grab it after the presentation, after you get home and so forth, you're welcome to do that. Or if you want, feel free to send me an email or tweet me or whatever. Facebook me, and I'd be happy to email it to you as well. Also, just as a point of note, throughout the presentation, occasionally you'll see some highlighted text with underline. Those are hyperlinks used occasionally throughout the presentation. That'll take you some additional information as well on that particular topic. So what I'm going to do today is give a real brief background on the OSHA inspection process, just touch on it, and then we'll get into some of the most common violations that are found in the breweries, specific to breweries, and then we'll get into OSHA record-keeping requirements. And I will preface this by saying that OSHA is expected to put out a new regulation later this week. That will kind of impact some of the information here potentially, but nevertheless, all this information will be available on the website. And again, if you have any questions during or after today's session or afterwards, if you get back, feel free to email me, and I'm happy to answer all the questions you may have. So first is the inspection process itself. Many folks, you know, kind of view it as a black box of, you know, what happens and how it works. Real quickly, the first thing that happens is that basically OSHA has to know that you exist in order to go inspect you, obviously. That's obviously an obvious comment. But the way that they find out about your brewery and the way that the data shows, we did a lot of data analysis before this presentation, what the data shows is that there's really two triggers as to what will facilitate a knock on the proverbial door, if you will, by OSHA. The first one and the most common one, again, specifically within the brewing industry, is going to be employee complaints. This has been something that OSHA has been promoting a lot of over the last 3 to 6 years or so, getting employees aware of their right to notify OSHA when they have a safety concern and requesting OSHA to come in. There's a whole process into that. I won't get into it, but suffice it to say that that's the number one most common reason why OSHA will visit the brewery. The second most common is something called the Special Emphasis Program, and these are very specific programs safety issues that OSHA wants to target, and they tend to be across industries. And there's about 100 of them or so scattered throughout the country. Each region and each local office kind of does their own thing. But there's a number of common ones that a brewery may become subject to in terms of an inspection. One of them is forklifts, also known as PITs, powered industrial trucks. That program oftentimes will trigger an inspection or a visit by OSHA to your brewery. And the other one is just generally material handling, so how you handle pallets and things of that sort. The caution that I'll say is that those inspections by the employer right have to be very focused, meaning if they knock on your door, the first thing that they're going to do is the opening conference, and they're going to tell you why they're there. We're here because we've received a complaint, an employee is concerned about XYZ, and we're here to take a look at that issue. And they'll go and they'll proceed through the inspection process on that particular issue. Similarly, with an emphasis program, if it's forklifts or material handling, they'll want to go and see the operations of where those activities are taking place. And those are referred to as partial inspections. But the thing that I'll make a point of is, although they may be there to see that specific issue, as they're walking around, as they're doing their so-called walkthrough, they'll be talking to employees and they'll be observing what else is going on throughout the brewery. And if they see other issues that brings great concern to them, it can expand the scope of the inspection. So I've seen it a number of times where they'll come in under one pretext, if you will, under one purpose, and it gets expanded into other things because as the compliance officer was walking through, they observed other potential issues that they wanted to take a look at. So they'll do that walkthrough. It could be, you know, under one visit. It could be under multiple visits. But it does have to be within a six-month period. So when they open up an inspection to the point of closing the inspection, it can take no longer than 6 months. In a brewery situation, it's typically a matter of a few days. Then there'll be a closing conference where they'll discuss some of the potential issues that they may cite. And then at some point, either at that closing conference or soon after, issue a citation if there is something that they feel was worthy of a citation. And then the employer from there, the brewer from there, has the opportunity, if they want, to contest it, is the legal term. It's basically appealing it. And then there's a whole process for that. But that's basically the process. And hopefully, with today's session, what we want to do is basically keep you out of that target box so that OSHA doesn't come and visit you to begin with, but also, obviously, keep the employees in the brewery and in the operations safe. So I got into some of the concepts of the partial inspection. That's what I was talking about before. They're in there for one issue. Those are called partial inspections, and they can expand from there. Very rarely, I'm not aware of any brewery inspections where it was a comprehensive inspection, which means it was a wall-to-wall. They literally looked at everything. I'm not familiar, at least not recently, of any brewery inspections where that happened. But as I said before, they can come in for one issue and expand it to others as they walk around. Now, when they come in for an inspection on a particular issue, PIT's forklifts or material handling or HAZCOM, whatever the particular topic may be, they'll ask for some of the materials that you may have. So they may ask you for your OSHA logs, and they may ask you for your written programs and proof of training and things of that sort. So that's where having your written programs in place and having employee training with logs and so forth becomes very important. And here's a list of some of the programs that may come up that would require a written program. Now, I will caveat this as well, is that there are some states where there is a requirement to have an overall program, where the brewer is going to be expected to have an overall safety and health program. These programs here are very topic specific. So with that, we'll get into the brewery violations and what we've seen in the brewer's industry. We did an analysis before I get into that slide. We went back and we looked at all of the inspection data from, I believe it was 2010 through calendar year 2015. And so that kind of gives a smoothing, if you will. So we've seen every year what all the issues were cited, how much they were cited for, and that kind of thing. I didn't want to, death by PowerPoint's bad enough. I didn't want to also do death by spreadsheet. So I combined those and kind of synthesized it into some of the key points. First, this slide, this is not particular to brewers. This is general industry and all industries as a wide spectrum. But the reason why I wanted to show this was because I was able to get the data and show what the average penalty amount. So you can see roughly what potentially could be issued as a citation or a violation for these particular issues. So they could range, on the HAZCOM, they tend to average around $850, all the way up into some of the machine guarding, $4,000. What's not on this list, but it is for brewers industry, is, for example, confined space. That tends to be a very high dollar amount. In fact, I recall from the data that that tends to be around the $6,000 range per violation. So the reason why this is important, in my opinion, is that it kind of gives you some indication of where the compliance officer's mind is when they're walking through the brewery. So they know that machine guarding issues are very dangerous. It could cause potential amputations and serious cuts and things of that sort. So they tend to issue citations that are much higher in penalty amounts as a result of that. So what are the easiest, you know, we'll call it the low-hanging fruit for an OSHA inspector. When an OSHA inspector comes in, they're going to expect to see the written programs and training and things of that sort. And the easiest things for them to cite is if they're coming in there for a lockout, tagout inspection, for example, or you know, whether it be a special emphasis program or complaint, whatever the case might be, they're going to ask, well, let me see your written program. Like, well, I don't have one. Okay, well, then that right there they know, okay, we're going to be issuing a citation on that. And some of them, like lockout, tagout, also require procedures for a specific lockout. So they're going to ask to see some of those, and that tends to be the lower-hanging fruit. On the training side, what's important to note is that it's not just providing training to your employees. It's making sure that the training is effective. And OSHA has a very specific definition of what effective means. To them, effective means that you gave the training, they understood the training, and they remember the training, they know how to apply it. So you could put in, you know, employees through death by PowerPoint, all that kind of stuff, and if they at the end of it, they don't, you know, none of the information is retained and they don't understand it, they don't know how to apply it, OSHA will still issue a citation even though you conducted the training. So this is why one of the things we always recommend and we always do for all of our clients is that we make sure that at the end of every training segment that there's a quiz. Just do a short 5, 8, 10 question quiz that summarizes the information so that they understand what they just learned, and you have documentation that it applied. One of the areas where the effectiveness comes into play, not all breweries are going to have this issue, but it's going to be with temporary workers, perhaps in warehouse or some of the other areas where you may have employees, particularly temporary employees, have English as a second language. So you want to make sure that the training is effective for them as well. And the last caveat I'll say is with regards to temporary workers, if you have seasonality or things of that sort that you bring in extra help, from OSHA's perspective, I'm not talking about wage and hour issues and things, you know, other tax issues or anything like that. I'm talking specifically from a safety compliance perspective. OSHA treats a temporary worker as though it is your worker. So it expects them to have some of the training, or actually all of the training that applies, that you would have given to your employees, that you had also given to the temporary employees. Now, obviously, you know, if the temporary employees are going nowhere near a vessel, you're not going to do confined space entry for them. But you do need to provide them with hazard communication so they know what chemicals are in the workplace and how to avoid them and things of that sort. And some of the other basic training that it will apply to them is absolutely very important that you provide that to those temporary workers. Otherwise, that is an area where OSHA will issue citations. So the most frequently cited violations in breweries, again, we did the analysis from 2010 to 2015, crunched all the numbers, and this is a ranked order of how often the citations come up. The first one is something called process safety management. I'm going to venture to guess it may be the first time many, if not all of you, have heard that in the craft brewing industry. The reason why that's on the top of the list is that anhydrous ammonia. I'm curious, anybody in here use anhydrous ammonia as a coolant? So you're the only one. Oh, I think I saw one more hand, yeah. So if you use it more than, 50,000 pounds? 10,000 pounds then the PSM standard is going to apply to you. The bigger brewers, you know, the Coors and so forth, they tend to, from my understanding, they tend to use more anhydrous, and that's why that'll come in at the top of the list. So with the exception of those two individuals, you could just scratch that off your list of interest in terms of OSHA requirements, because it's only going to affect those two that raise their hands. The next one is most often cited is respiratory protection and PPE, which is personal protective equipment. Again, that's a very easy one for OSHA to cite. Yeah, somebody has a question?
Yeah, just stepping back, which written programs are mandatory?
Lockout, tagout requires, actually, you know what, I think I have a slide on that a little bit later, but lockout, tagout, HAZCOM, confined space, respiratory protection, bloodborne, again, all of these are if it applies to you, so there has to be an assessment to determine whether or not it even applies to you, but most of these it will. Noise conservation, I can't think of any others off the top of my head. And in some states, about half the states, an overall written safety and health management program is required as well in about half of the states. I won't get into the legal details as to why that is, but it is what it is. So that particularly applies if you're in California, Washington State, or Oregon, Washington State, California, Michigan. They have very strong enforcement there of the overall safety. Yeah. Yeah. So I hope that answered your question. So on the respiratory protection PPE, so you know you're either wearing chemical gloves when you're handling caustic or you're not. You're either wearing the chemical resistant apron or you're not. It's very simple things for the compliance officer to determine. With respiratory protection, that's an interesting one because this is. From our experience in the number of breweries that we've been in, this is one area. I want to be careful how I say this. I'll describe it as this is a situation where sometimes it's no good deed goes unpunished kind of a scenario, where if you're using a respirator with the cartridges and that kind of thing, you're trying to do good, you know, trying to keep the employees protected, but then you don't have the respiratory protection program and the fit test, the medical evaluations, and all that kind of stuff that goes behind it to do it. And they're really wearing it because they want to avoid dust from the mill room or something to that effect. So with respiratory protection, I'll say that that's one area that we've seen that's where they'll target, is that you know you're using it as a voluntary program. But when it comes to those kinds of respirators, if you're in for a penny, you're in for a pound. So you got to do it the whole way. Now, there is an exception with dust masks. OSHA does have an exception where you can do an evaluation, and if the employee only really needs is a dust mask, you can offer that as optional for the employee, and they can wear it. So a lot of times you'll see it used in the mill room or someplace where there's a lot of dust like that. And that's an easy way to kind of bypass some of that. What I'll say is all that requires is just a real simple analysis of, okay, you know, we don't have exposures that require respiratory protection. We're going to do voluntary dust masks for things like, the mill room and you just documented it and then you're good. Lockout, tagout is one that they really they cite a lot on for not having a program and then not having or following the procedures to conduct a lockout or a tagout, and we'll get into some of those specifics as well. Confined space. If there's a couple of things that should keep a brewer up at night, so to speak, when it comes to safety. In my opinion, the top of the list would be confined space. So those of you that were at the previous session, that was a very important session to go to. And if you didn't go, or if you're listening to this later, I would highly recommend that you go back and listen to that that presentation, because that's probably the top. That's really where somebody can get killed. And there's a number of cases in Mexico and in Ireland, I think it was, or Great Britain somewhere. Multiple fatality situations, because what ends up happening is one person goes down from high CO2 exposure. Their friend sees them and they want to go out and, you know, they want to go in there and save them. And then that person goes down, and then the next one, and the next one, and the next one. And that's why whenever you see a confined space CO2 kind of a fatality scenario, it tends to be more than one, and it's because of that. That's why confined space scenarios are very important. Hazardous communication is a real easy one. Is it what chemicals are in the workplace? For you guys, it's typically acids and caustics, and just the basics of knowledge on how to handle those. You know, what PPE you need to have when you're handling those, and not storing them in close proximity where they can spill into each other and that kind of thing. So the hazard communication is one that's frequently cited. Machine guarding, equipment guarding. A lot of times you'll see that on the bottling line, where somebody may have either removed or, you know, temporarily removed a plexiglass door, for example, or something like that, and they're still operating the line. FOSHA saw that. Oftentimes, if they saw that, they would cite that under the machine guarding standard. Pits and forklifts, that's very frequently cited. Typically, it's along the lines of training. But sometimes it's also where you get into trying to use forklift as a man lift. I've seen some situations where, you know, somebody will stand on a pallet and just, you know, go up on the forklift. That's a real quick citation from OSHA. That's a real pet peeve from OSHA perspective. And then working surfaces. There's one thing I'll go back and I'll say about an OSHA inspector when they come in. It's like anything else. If they come in and they see that it's a clean brewery, it's, you know, there's not a lot of good hygiene, if you will, and you have some of the basic programs, and you know, you just generally quote unquote look good, so to speak. Their frame of mind is it'd be a lot different than if they walked in and they saw, like, you know, like from the show Hoarders, mess everywhere and everything else. They're just going to have a totally different perspective, and they're going to have a different mindset, and that will influence how they conduct the inspection. And then the last one I have listed here is safety showers. And with safety showers, we've always seen that they're there, and that's great. But when they cite the safety showers, the vast majority of the time, what they're citing is actually because an employee, if somebody needed to use it, they can't, because there's all sorts of boxes or pallets blocking the way, or chemical drums in the way, or whatever the case might be. So you kind of have to, when you look at your safety showers, think about it, like, if I just got chemical in my eye, would I be able to find it and use it right away? And, you know, that's kind of like the mental test you should have. And a lot of times when these are getting cited, it's because there's something blocking the way. And it doesn't happen as often, but sometimes it's also that, like on the temporary ones, like sometimes you'll see those wall-mounted ones. The liquid in there hasn't been, you know, changed out in 4 years or something. That would mean that it's not ready for use, and they'll cite for that. So what I've done is on the next few slides, I'm not going to read through these, but these are the very specific, what's called regulatory language that's used when they issue the citation and the penalty amount. These are the references that they're going to. So I've mentioned before about safety showers, and you'll see somewhere in there we'll talk about immediate, right at the very end, for immediate emergency use. So that's why they're citing that standard when they can't access the safety showers. So for lockout, tagout, somebody asked about written programs. This is one where they'll issue citations because you don't have the procedures for how to lock out a particular program. So that needs to be done. And then record keeping and some of these others. The record keeping, this, you know, it gets cited, but I'll be honest on this one. The penalty amounts, they're not very high. It's like a couple hundred bucks typically. But every year, the executive at that brewery needs to review and sign off on the OSHA logs. And I'll explain why that is important here in a few minutes. Hazardous waste and emergency response. An emergency response plan. This is a bunch of language. Basically what it means is you don't have a plan in place. When they cite this, what they're saying is that you don't have a plan in place if your 50-gallon or whatever size caustic drum ruptures and or tips and it spills everywhere. You don't have a plan in place to deal with that scenario, with that situation. So that's they'll cite for that. That's typically, on this particular standard, that's typically what it is. Guarding and holes in the floor, a lot of this has, it's, a lot of times this deals with handrails. So you may have stairs and work platforms at above a fermenter, for example, but you may have a section of guarding that's not there, or guardrails that's not there because you want to be able to access a hatch or something like that. If OSHA goes up there, that could be a potential citation. So those are some of the things that they'll cite for that. Respiratory protection. Again, like I said before, this is one of those scenarios from what we've seen. I mean, obviously, we haven't been in every brewery, but often when we see this, it's one of those no good deed goes unpunished kind of a situation. And we talked about PPE. And then confined space. You do need to go through and specifically identify what spaces are confined space and permit required confined space, and that you've done an analysis on those. Again, I'll refer you to the previous presentation for that for more details on that. But there needs to be an assessment that you looked at. Okay, bright tanks, we're going to treat them this way, and this is what's required. Fermenters, brew house tanks, things of that sort, that you've gone through and you've looked at all those tanks and you've identified which ones are confined space for compliance purposes. So that's the most common one, and there's a lot of detail goes behind this. If you're a spreadsheet nerd and you want to email me, you want to get a copy of the spreadsheet, by all means, feel free to email me. I'm happy to send it to you, but I try to synthesize it as best I could to kind of keep it to the high key points, the high level key points. The next one on record keeping, a lot of folks might say, you know, record keeping, what does that have to do with safety? What I talked about before at the very beginning was that target selection box and some of the things that can get you into that box. Record keeping is one of those topics that could inadvertently get you into the crosshairs, if you will, with OSHA. And I'll get into why that is and some of the things that you need to do to be in compliance. The first thing I'll say is that last year there was a new reg that was put out. If you have a fatality at your brewery, God forbid, you have to notify OSHA within 8 hours. And then if you have anybody who has an amputation, so anything from a tip of a finger to a whole leg, basically it constitutes anything like a piece of bone, it has to be reported within 24 hours. And if you have anybody who's admitted into the hospital, that means that they're given a bed, not a trip to the ER and released, but an actual admission into the hospital where they get a room number, so to speak. Those have to be notified to OSHA. I mentioned amputation and then a loss of eye injury. And then when you notify OSHA, last year was the first full year that this went into effect. There was about 10,000 to 12,000 cases that went to OSHA, and they ended up inspecting a little bit less than half of that. So they do go through a process, they call it a triage process, and they'll basically figure out which ones they want to inspect because it's hard for them to inspect them all. So they basically figured out a process to hit the ones that would be of most, that they think would be of most concern to them, and they'll send someone out there to conduct an inspection. Some of these, like a fatality, that's always going to trigger an inspection. That's always going to trigger a visit from OSHA. So here's where I think record keeping is going to be important. Again, we went back and we looked at the Bureau of Labor Statistics data going all the way back to 2003, specific for the brewing industry. And you'll see the trend line The top is for an OSHA recordable. These are things like cuts and broken arms and things of that sort. You'll see the trend on this line. This is for all industries across the board. And then the blue line is specific to brewing. And then the one below that, the two lines below that is the same thing. All industries and then just brewing over the last 12, 15 years. And you'll see that there's generally, it's choppy for the brewing industry, but it's generally down, I'd say. So it kind of begs, and this DART is basically lost time accident. So somebody who couldn't go to work for 2 days, 1 day, a week, a month, whatever the case might be, or you had to transfer them into another, you had to restrict their duties or transfer them into another job. So if they're a production person and, you know, they break a leg, well, they can't do their job as effectively, and you move them over into, you know, an office job or something else to as part of their employment, that would fall under this bottom category. So what's interesting to me when I saw this data, the first thing that jumped out at me, so think of the top line as quote-unquote minor injuries or the, you know, smaller injuries, and the bottom one is more serious. Again, I'm using terms loosely here. You'll see that the top one, trend goes down, but then over the last couple of years, it skyrockets up. So according to the data, it says, well, there's a lot of injuries, quote-unquote minor, minor injuries, a spike here, but there's not a corresponding serious injury at the bottom. You would think that they would be much more correlated. So it begs the question, you know, are the brewers getting more savvy on, you know, OSHA logs and the requirements with OSHA record keeping, that they're creating a scenario where they're over reporting? Is that a real problem? Short answer is I don't know. That's one of the reasons why I'm giving this particular section of the talk, is to educate you a little bit on record keeping so that you record an actual injury. You have to record those if it's a recordable. But if it's not a recordable, keep it on a separate log, take note of it, investigate it, do what changes you need to have done so it doesn't happen again and all those kinds of things. But don't have it on your OSHA logs. And the reason why I say that is because I mentioned before, later this week, there's going to be a new reg, and that new reg potentially could require not all of the brewers, but it may require a few of you, depending on how the reg reads when it comes out, to report your data. And if you're reporting data that shows a really high rate, that's going to trigger somebody back at OSHA scratching their head, going, "Wow, there's a lot of injuries there. We need to go visit them." The purpose of this next section is so that you have a basic understanding of what is and is not a recordable. So that's the reason why it's, here's a list of some of the reasons why it's important. Aside from understanding where the injuries are occurring in your brewery, so that you can address trends and do investigations and corrective actions so they don't happen again, but you also want to avoid over-reporting because you don't want to unnecessarily draw the attention of regulators to come in and visit you. So those are some of the cases. And I will say this, of all the breweries we've gone in, I can't think of a brewery. I'm going to say there was just because, law of averages, maybe there was one. But there's no brewery that comes to mind where there were not cases of over-reporting. And I'll get into some examples of actual examples from brewers of what we've seen. So before we get into that, I want to just kind of walk through just a little bit on record keeping and what is a recordable. There's some links here. You can read into it in detail in the OSHA logs. What I'm going to focus on more is basically your general reporting requirements, recording requirements for a recordable case. Because if you understand that, that'll cover 90 to 95% of what you're dealing with. Every time I give a presentation on record keeping, it is the most nuanced, most painstaking subject in all of OSHA. I mean, there's some folks that literally just do this as a living, just record keeping, and and monitoring employers' logs and so forth, so to make sure that they're accurate. It is a very hyper nuanced field. So we'll get into some of the unique cases, and of course, if you have any questions of specific cases that you may be dealing with, I can give you a off the cuff answer of what I think it would be. But so what is a recordable? You know, you have an injury on the site. You know, how do I know if I have to record it on the logs or it's not a recordable? Well, there's a 5-step process, and you go through this process, and you answer the it's a very simple question. You answer it yes or no, and if it's no, at any point along the way, if it's no, it's not a recordable. Done. End of story. Do not record it permanently on your log. If at any, when it's a yes, you keep moving down to the next question. You ask the next question: does it meet this? Yes or no. And if you keep going all the way down, and if the answer is yes all the way down to the bottom, then it is a recordable. So the first question that gets asked is: was there an injury? We're not. It doesn't matter if it was, you know, somebody else. You know, it was a fight or you know, a car accident. You know, whatever the case might be, it doesn't matter. At this, the very first question you're asking is: was there an injury or was there an illness? It's a yes or no question. It's very simple. A lot of times, some employers will get they'll try to mix all these things together, and they end up getting confused. So, if you follow this model, nine times out of ten, if not better, you'll come up with the right answer. So, was there an injury or an illness? Yes or no? Let's pretend it was a yes. Person twisted their ankle. Okay, the next one was going to say, well, is the injury work-related? So did they twisted their ankle. Did it happen at work, or did it happen when they were at the hotel tonight and when you go back to your room? Is that, if you twist your ankle in your hotel room, is that an OSHA recordable for your employer? That's where the work-related comes into place. Now, I will say that OSHA their initial presumption is that all injuries are workplace related. If it happened while you're at work or while you're doing something that's at the benefit of the employer, it is work related. That's their presumption. There are, like everything else, there are exceptions to the rule, and that's where all this nuanced stuff kind of comes into play, and we'll get into some of those. So, was it work related? If it happened at the brewery, 99 times out of 100, the answer is going to be yes. Is it a new case? So, is it a new case? And the subtext to that is it an aggravation of an injury that you got playing soccer over the weekend, kind of a scenario? So that comes into place. So if it's a new case, then it is going to be a recordable, and you move on. And then the last question you ask is, does it meet the general criteria of what is an injury? And what I'll say is, if it requires medical treatment, meaning if you have to go to the doctor and they have to prescribe medicine or anything like that, then that becomes medical treatment and it does become a recordable. It's a yes and it goes on to a recordable. So this gets really complicated. I'll go through some examples and hopefully that'll be clearer. The number one reason why, in my opinion, cases get over-recorded on a brewer's logs is because it's actually a first aid case, and they're being over careful, if you will, and they're going to record it on their logs anyway. So here's a little bit of a laundry list on what is first aid. And again, if it is first aid, it is by definition not a recordable. So if it's non-prescription, meaning you get Neosporin and you put it on your cut and you put a Band-Aid on there, that, at no point did that require a doctor's prescription, right? So that's a non-prescription, that's first aid. However, if the doctor prescribes you, you know, Percocet because you really messed up your back or something like that, then that does be that the Percocet would, barring anything else as well, the Percocet itself would make it a recordable. Tetanus, anything that has to do with immunizations, like if you get a tetanus shot, you get a cut and you get a tetanus shot, that tetanus shot is an exemption. It's considered to be first aid. It's not going to be recordable. Same thing with x-rays or ultrasounds or CT scans, anything like that. Anything that's diagnostic, blood tests, anything like that that's diagnostic in nature, the doctor's trying to figure out what's going on, that is not considered by the OSHA standard to be medical treatment. So you'll see the whole list here, everything, you know, washing your eyes out, cleaning a blister, applying a Band-Aid, applying some sort of ointment, over-the-counter ointment, things like that. Those are all first aids and not considered to be a recordable. So you'll see these all listed here. And again, we have some examples from brewers of where they're being overly cautious, if you will, on what is and isn't a recordable. So you get all those onto you get all the yeses, you record it onto the log. You are required to keep the 300, 300A, and 301 logs. Every year, you have to post what's called the 300A. It's a summary. You have to post it in the brewery somewhere where the employees can see it. It kind of summarizes total hours worked, how many injuries there were, and a basic categorization of how many of what type of injury, a cut, poisoning, whatever the case might be. And you have to keep those logs for 5 years. One of the things I'll say about the OSHA logs, there's nothing wrong with, because sometimes it takes some time to figure out what kind of an injury this is. There's nothing wrong with initially writing it on the log, and then when you find out that it's later, okay, you know what, we investigated it, it was only a first aid, it's not an OSHA recordable. There's nothing wrong with just taking a pencil or a pen and just, or white out or whatever it is, and just drawing a line through it and taking it off. There's nothing wrong with doing that. So you could put it on on the log, but at the end of the year or at the end of the investigation, if it's not a recordable, you should take that item off the list. And as I said before, the logs do need to be recorded by a brewery executive. This is a lot of fine print meant to hurt your eyes. These are general exemptions, you know. So what happens if I'm eating lunch at work and I choke and it requires me to go to the hospital and I have to stay in the hospital because I got some weird, you know, whatever. There's certain exceptions that apply that does not make it a recordable. A common one in northern part of states, for example, colds or flus. Somebody comes with the flu and, you know, they start spreading it from employee to employee. Those are illnesses. Those are work-related. You know, you go through all that checklist that we talked about before, the five-step process. It's yes, 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 yes. But OSHA is acknowledging that that's an exception. They're giving an exception to that because there's very little an employer can do to mitigate some of that. But so that's a common exception that gets applied. The flu. Let me see if there's another one that that jumps out at here. Personal tasks. If you leave work, you're going from, let's say you have two brewery facilities, and you go out and run some errand. You're going from one brewery to the other, but you do a sidetrack and you go to the grocery store. You go run an errand, dry cleaner, whatever, and then you go back to work. While you're doing that detour, you get in a car accident or you get injured or something like that, that's going to be an exception. That's quote-unquote personal time, and it's not going to apply as a recordable injury. As well as, I know a lot of you do company events where the employees come in and you do, you'll go into the tap room, for example, and you'll have friends and family day or whatever the case might be. And someone gets hurt while they're doing that. That's also an exception because you're there as quote a member of the public, not really as an employee. So that would be an exception. So there's a whole slew of them. I mentioned before about hotel room. OSHA views a hotel room just like it does your house. So you have an injury at your house. It's not going to be an OSHA recordable, obviously. They apply the same concept to hotels. So when you travel and you get to the hotel, you check in, you're off the OSHA clock, so to speak. So here's some examples. Head brewer got grain dust in his eye and used a nearby eye wash to get it out. The eye was irritated, but there was no treatment needed. Didn't, just flushed it out and they were okay to go.
That is not going to be recordable because the use of the safety shower is exactly what you're supposed to do, but that's a first aid. They're just flushing the eye out, and he's good to go. So how does that become a recordable? Well, they go to the doctor, and the doctor has to give some special medicated eye drops and maybe a prescription drug of some kind. Then that does make it, that would convert it from a first aid into medical treatment. A brewer was struck by a piece of equipment, got a bruise and a small cut, no stitches, put some Neosporin and Band-Aid, no other medical treatment was sought. It's not a recordable. Neosporin is off the shelf. They put a Band-Aid on. That's all first aid. The fact that you get a bruise, this is one comp. We've seen this a number of times where they assume that getting a bruise on their leg or on their arm would make it a recordable, and that's not the case. It would if it prevented them from being able to do their job for, you know, 2 or 3 days or whatever the case might be. Then that would make it what I was talking about before with being a dark case, lost time or something like that. That would make it a convertible, recordable. But in this particular case, it's not. An employee was mugged. This is an unusual one. An employee was mugged while performing work duties away from the brewery. He went home due to distress and sore shoulder, but no doctor, did not visit a doctor, turned to work the next day. Not a recordable. What I will say, you know, at a brewery, two employees, let's say they get in a fight and, you know, one gets knocked out or something like that. That would be a recordable, even though it's you know, a fight, and that would make it a recordable. Employee leaves work on the this one was not at a brewery. This one was at a different employer, but it made it in there for some reason. Employee leaves work at the back of an intoxicated boyfriend's motorcycle. They crashed in the parking lot, requiring an ambulance to be called, and they had to go to the hospital. And there was all sorts of medical treatment. OSHA. This is one that trips up a lot of employers, actually. OSHA considers you to be what I'll call on the clock for safety purposes. The minute you turn off your car and open your car door, you are now in the workplace, as far as OSHA is concerned. So if you get out of the car and you close the door and you slam your finger and you break it in three places and all that kind of stuff, that is a recordable. Because once you open up that car door, the car door is off, you open up the car door, it does become a recordable. It kind of drives some people crazy. I can understand that, but it is what it is. Conversely, after the day is over, you get on your motorcycle, you turn it on, or you get in your car. The second you get in the car, you close the door, you're on your own time. You're not on the OSHA clock, if you will. And then lastly, this one did happen with a brewer. An employee was stung by a bee at an event. They didn't go into any sort of anaphylactic shock. Thank you. There was no sort of thing like that. It was just a bee sting. It hurt, and that was it. That's not going to be a recordable. If they did go into shock and they had to go to the hospital and administer epinephrine or get an EpiPen or anything like that, then that would very well convert that into a recordable. So with that, I'll get into some frequently asked questions, and then obviously if you have any questions you all have, we're happy to answer them. A question we get a lot with when we get into record keeping and logs is, we have to do workers' comp logs. Could I use my workers' comp logs as my OSHA logs? And the answer to that is OSHA views workers' logs as completely separate and distinct from workers' comp logs. However, if the information you are capturing on your workers' comp logs is the same as what is required on an OSHA on the OSHA form, the OSHA 300 forms, the 301, 300A, etc., if it's asking all the information that's on the OSHA logs, then you can use OSHA will be okay with that. But if there's some information that's on the workers' comp log if not all of the information on the OSHA log is on the workers' comp log, then you can't do it. I hope that was clear. Temporary workers and staffing agency employees, They, as I said before early on, those are treated as the same. From an OSHA perspective, and it's also smart business. You want to make sure that these temporary workers are not going to be unnecessarily subjected to serious hazards. So just make sure that they have the they're aware of the PPE that's required. If they're doing material handling, things like that, they know about wearing gloves. They know about wearing safety glasses if it requires it. Things of that sort. So. Temporary employees are counted as actual OSHA employees. And then lastly, how do I handle a case that's not obvious whether the event occurred at work or not? This is where you basically sometimes you just have to call somebody who knows and kind of go through, you know, walk through the scenario and make a determination as to whether or not it is. A recordable injury. One last thing I'll make a comment on, since this triggered my memory on something that we get asked a lot, is if there's a medical opinion and the medical opinion says, yes, this is a, you know, it's a fracture or it's a medical diagnosis of some kind, something like that, or this person can't, they hurt their back, they can't return to work for a week, something like that, that makes it a recordable because you have a medical doctor saying they were injured and, you know, they're going to be away from work for a period of time. If you wanted to get a second opinion, if there's a second opinion, there is a process to go through for a second opinion on medical opinions, and then it's up to the employer to decide ultimately who's right. This is what this is the last couple of slides. This is what the log looks like. As I said before, you can log it on there, and if the injury proves out to be later not a recordable, you just go through and you strike it out. You can make any edits you need to make, changes you need to make on it along the way. It's the point at which it becomes written in stone, if you will, is at the end of the year when there has to be an annual a review of all the injuries and logs and kind of account for what is and isn't recordable, and all the injuries that occurred. That at that point, anything that's not on the list that shouldn't be on the list, you should definitely go back and scratch them off. This is what the 301 looks like. This is basically an accident investigation form, OSHA Form 301. It asks you all the questions, and it basically walks you through an accident investigation. Who was doing what, where, when, why, how, all that kind of stuff. And those you need to do those for each one of the recordable injuries. And then this is the 300A form that is required to be posted from February 1st to April 30th in the workplace. And as I said before, it'll summarize how many injuries you had, what kind of injury, and then over here it'll give information about your facility, what industry code it is. For your industry code is 312120. And then how many employees' hours were worked, and then you'll calculate out from there. There's an equation on what your injury and illness rate is, and that's pretty much it. What I will say also is on this, if you have temporary workers, you can count, because they're on your clock, so to speak, when they're at your site, you can count those hours, add it to your hours to calculate what your injury and illness rate is. So that is a plus. If you keep them safe, there's no injuries there, that'll help lower your rate. And conversely, if they have a lot of injuries, then obviously that'll count against you too. That was it. Happy to answer any questions you might have. And yes.
So are the requirements the same if you say have 3 employees or 30 employees?
I'm glad you raised that. I should have included that in the slides, but I tried to be concise. There is partial, what OSHA calls these partial exemptions. Some industries are safe enough under OSHA's perspective that they don't require a lot of these OSHA logs. Certain retail, for example, like a Walmart, or not a Walmart, a 7-Eleven or something. There are certain retail exemptions as well. I'll bring it back to the brewers. From a brewer's perspective, if you have fewer than 10, then you are exempt from keeping logs unless OSHA comes, the Bureau of Labor Statistics, or somebody comes to you and says, give us your data. Then you have to produce that data and give it to them. Or unless it changes in this new reg that's expected out at the end of the week, that could change things as well. I don't think it will for the brewers. I don't think it'll affect the brewers very much. So if you have fewer than 10, that includes temporary workers. And that includes at any point during the year. So if on January 1, you had 6 employees. On August 1st, you had 10. And the rest of the, and it was, you had 10 employees literally for one day. And then you went back down to six employees for the rest of the year. It triggers it. So you have to have 10 or more employees for just one day. And that includes your employees and temporary employees. That's a good question. Sorry? That also, no, that those count as employees. They count. Yeah.
So you have so basic injury that does not require an overnight stay in a hospital in a bed, not a court. Is there a time?
It could be recordable depending on what the injury, because he or she may have been given prescriptions or something like that. Yeah, but you would have to report it if they spend any time in the hospital. You do have to report that to OSHA. If they're given a hospital, a hospital bed, they have to be, that has to be reported to OSHA.
That has to be reported. But if they're still home with medication,
if they go into the ER and they have a cut and all the doctor does is rinse it out, puts Neosporin on there and a Band-Aid and sends them home or her home, not a recordable. Just because a doctor put the Neosporin on there doesn't matter. It has to be medical, what they consider to be medical treatment. They applied stitches. If only a doctor or a medical professional, if it requires a medical professional to do whatever it was that was done, then that would make it a
recordable.
You have to log the number of days on that case, but it does not go into the calculation of what your rate is. So if a person, so from a DART, what's called the DART rate, if a person is injured and is sent home for, let's say, a short three days, or maybe a long 3 days, but anyway, they're sent home for 3 days, that would count from an OSHA calculation of what your DART rate is. That would count the same as though they were out for 5 months. Yes?
You mentioned a couple of times these forms need to be filled out by a brewery executive.
They need to be signed.
Okay.
They need to be. There has to be an executive that physically signs off on the form. Obviously, a safety manager or a brewmaster or a production supervisor, whomever, can manage the logs throughout the year, but there has to be an executive that's kind of like oversight, if you will, that buys off on it, that signs off on it.
What does OSHA see as an executive?
Typically, it's going to be the highest ranking person at the site, typically. So if that's the president, or if it's, I know some brewers might have multiple locations, but typically it's going to be like the highest ranking person at that site.
Thank you.
Yep.
You mentioned that there is a OSHA clock that starts when you turn off the car,
yeah,
and then stops when you turn on. What if you're in a big city? I'm in Boston, so I'll have people arriving by public transportation or by bicycle or walking. When does that clock start and stop for them?
Once they come on the property.
The moment they cross, just that.
Yeah, the moment. So if they're walking through the parking lot and you're in Massachusetts,
yeah,
there's ice, slip, fall, break their hip.
Got it.
Yep.
But the car, they can drive onto the property, but it doesn't count until they turn it off.
Right.
Okay.
Well, for the person that's inside the car, if they strike a person who's walking in. I'm sorry? Good question. How does that work if it's a company vehicle? It's the same. Yeah,
it depends on what they're doing. I mean, if they have a company vehicle and they're driving to and from work, they're commuting. My opinion would be that it would not be a recordable. You know, it would follow the same clock thing. But if they're getting in the car and they're going to an event or they're going to another brewery, you know, down the street or whatever the case might be for work, then I would say that would be that you're on the quote unquote OSHA clock. That's a term that's just a term I coined, by the way. It's not an official term.
How do you handle an injury that you perceive as a recordable, but the employee is refusing medical treatment?
That is a great question. I've never been asked that question. The employee, so they get hurt. Let's say they get a bruise.
They fell down. They got a huge cut in their leg. And I'm like, hey, man, I think you need stitches. You should probably go to the doctor. And they're like, I'm tough. I'll wrap it up in some gauze. I'm going to keep going.
That is a great question.
Especially working with brewers, everyone's tough. So
yeah. Remember when I said it was really nuanced and all that stuff? That's a stumper.
Okay. I would say, if it was,
I don't want to go down that path. If it was me and I was the manager, I personally would require that employee to do it, because what's going to happen is that employee is going to go back and get infected or something like that, and then it becomes a big liability issue.
So basically, you can't refuse medical treatment.
I don't know. My gut says that it's more of an employment issue than it is an OSHA issue. But I don't know the answer to that question. I'll be honest with you. I'll have to research it, and I'll post it on my Facebook or on Twitter.
Thank you.
I'll do that. So just look, if you like me on Facebook or Twitter, I'll answer that question. Yes.
kind of have two questions.
Sure.
First is, I understand that once a contractor enters your work site, your property, then you're responsible for providing the correct OSHA, protections for that contractor. So if, like, my electrician comes on site and they're injured, can you offer advice for recording people who don't work for you but you're still required through OSHA? And my second one was advice for somebody who has an injury, like they hurt them, turn their ankle playing volleyball or their back or something, and they come to work. By all appearances to you, they look fine, they're walking fine. You allow them to work, and they injure themselves, like, for recording, because it kind of, goes out of your flow chart of, like, a pre-existing condition.
Right.
You know, like, where does liability in OSHA cross? Or, like, a person with a medical condition that you're aware of, like whether you're allowing them to do or not do some things according to what their doctor says, and where that crosses with maybe HIPAA violations.
Right.
Like, how do you protect
The first question is, it's called the multi-employer policy. You are responsible for the contractor's safety. There are some things you can do to protect yourself as the host employer, as the brewer. There's some things, for example, electricians is a great example. Because brewers very rarely have electricians on staff. They hire, a master electrician firm to come in. And so I would say a lot of it would be in the way you protect yourself is selecting a contractor that has a good, ask them for their OSHA records, ask them to prove that their employees have been trained and basically vet them from a safety perspective. It'd be one way to protect yourself. There may be some things with contract language as well when you hire the contractor to come on site that, they're going to be expected to follow the safety requirements and things like that. But OSHA does presume, when they're on site, OSHA presumes that you, the host employer, are keeping an eye on them. And if they're doing stuff that they're not supposed to be doing, that you're checking up on them and correcting them. Now, there's some things, especially when it comes to electricity or electrical, you don't have the expertise for that, but you have to demonstrate, good faith effort that you try to keep on top of that employer. Because a lot of times, very frequently, the employer, OSHA, will cite the contractor and then turn around and also cite the host employer. That happens quite a bit. What I would say is just due diligence. Make sure that when they come on site, you vetted them. They don't have any real serious known OSHA history problems, that they have their safety programs in place and things like that. The next question was, what happens if you know that they're not with it and they get hurt? That's still on you.
Or say, like you said, someone throws out their back. Well, what if they're like, oh, I tweaked my back playing ultimate frisbee or volleyball, you know, the night before, but they're walking around fine, they look good. They say they're fine. They didn't go to seek treatment.
Right.
But then they ended up, like, they're rolling kegs or something, and they tweak something.
Yep. That would trigger that 5-step process. Because they aggravated it at work. So, that would apply. I hope that answers your question.
Yeah. Sure. Thank you for your time.
Yeah, thanks. Okay. Can we take one more? Yeah, sure.
Just quick, about the 10 employee.
Yes.
I have two locations.
Yes.
Both of them have less than 10 employees, but combined more.
Okay.
So,
there's a provision for multi-establishment. So I would have to ask you, are they close enough together? Are they, in different states?
Yeah, no, it's 60 miles apart.
Let me look at the standard. I'll tweet the answer.
Okay.
Or Facebook the answer. I'll put it on both. That's quite common as well. Those are employees. Those are remote employees. Those get counted.
Sorry to step in here. I know we got to cut that a little bit short, but I just want to thank everyone for coming. Thanks a lot to Gabe for being here today. And just as a bit of housekeeping, as you're making your way out, given that everyone's here on the safety track of things, we do have the Safety Sustainability Brewers Association Subcommittee meeting. So they're going to do a little meet and greet. That's going to be in 118B from 4 until 5:30. We'll have some beer and snacks over there. So if you feel like going over and meeting that subcommittee, please do head over and introduce yourself. Thanks a lot.